the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first it was kind of soy sauce, it was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history. And
hello everyone, and welcome back to Sake On Air, an on-air forum dedicated to exploring, discovering, and celebrating the fascinating culture that surrounds Japanese sake and shochu. I'm Rebecca, and joining me on the panel today are our passionate team of sake and shochu advocates. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hello, Rebecca. Hello.
Hi. Would you like to go around and just let everyone know who's here?
Hello, I'm Sebastian Lemoine.
And I'm Christopher Pellegrini.
And I'm here today, very honored. My name is Pablo Alomar Salvioni from Spain.
Right, so everyone, to our returning listeners, I'd just like to say a big, first of all, welcome back. We really appreciate your ongoing support and feedback to Sake On Air. And if you're tuning in for the first time, welcome. Hello. We really hope this show will support you on your own personal sake and shochu journey. You can follow us on Facebook, Insta, Twitter, you know, all the regular places for updates on upcoming shows. Now, for those of you who are new to us, let me just give you a rundown on what we do. Every 2 weeks around, we try to bring you news, stories, voices, and insights, as well as hopefully some animated discussions on sake and shochu from across Japan and to the furthest frontiers that these glorious beverages are reaching around the world. Which brings me nicely to introducing Pablo. Today, we're really delighted to have Pablo here joining us all the way from Madrid, Spain. Thanks for coming, Pablo.
Thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. And as some of our European listeners will be aware, Pablo is a passionate sake and shochu advocate who is expanding awareness and appreciation of sake in the Iberian Peninsula. And today we're going to do a deep dive on who you are and what you're doing. So I'm looking forward to getting to know more about your story, Pablo.
Okay, here we go. So my story with sake came along with the story of Japan. At some point, I decided to move to Tokyo. That was 20 years ago. I was into wine. I really like wine. I still do. But at that moment, I found out that wine in Japan was really expensive. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, I couldn't afford to drink wines in Tokyo. And the obvious drink that I would follow would be beer. But in fact, I really don't like beer. And I think that's the thing that put me into sake, because without drinking beer, the next thing that I was searching here in Japan was maybe umeshu, was easy to drink. The last thing I wanted to drink was sake, because I had, like most of European or foreigners, a kind of image of sake not according to reality. So I didn't want to get into sake because I thought it was a horrible drink. Then at that time when I was in Japan, there was a kind of shochu boom. So I had to drink a lot of shochu. But for me, shochu was a little bit strong. And at the end of the day, I got into sake and I said, wow, this is fantastic. The sake is so nice, so good priced. So I got this idea that would be related to me somehow in the future. Then I was working with wines. I started a company that I'm still running, introducing wines, Spanish wines mainly here in Japan. And I was meeting some Japanese sake producers in wine fairs in Europe, or for instance in Singapore, in Asia, China. And I got into exchanging sake for wine, and I used to get a very big amount of sake to bring to Spain. And at some point, one of the guys, I don't know if I can say the name, but
I know the story, and actually it's a really fun story. Can you just wind back a little bit? You made some friends with, I believe, some younger brewers, is that correct?
That's right.
And you went out to for a night out, and yeah. You pick up the story from there.
Yeah, so I was with this young brewer, very famous brewery now, but that wasn't that famous at that time. And we went to an izakaya, you know, just as a friend, drink a little bit of his sake. We start to drink a little bit more and more and more and more. We got kind of drunk. And at some point in the night, which I don't really remember, he said, hey, why don't you become our importer in your country? And then I can introduce you to some other breweries so you can get a nice pack of sakes to Spain. And I say, yes. I would say yes to everything at that night. So next morning, I got his call. Hey, we have a meeting, dinner tonight. And I brought some presidents of some breweries that you must meet. And let's start the Spanish thing. And I was like, excuse me? Are you talking to me?
Oh, the regret. Oh, the regret. The walk of shame in the morning when you realize you just started up a sake import company.
It was. You know, I of the years I was here in Japan, I learned a little bit about Japanese culture. And I know that if you say yes, you cannot say no at the next day. So I said, okay, I do it. And then I was like, all morning thinking what to say, how to find an excuse and blah, blah. But then I had the meeting. I give a kind of real story about sake in Spain. I was making them not expecting too much. But I say, okay, we should organize a trip to Spain tasting. And then I was trying to find out a way to escape, in the sense that maybe I don't do the import. I just do the agent work like I do with wine, so I don't have any risk. But I found out that the Spanish importers, they were not into sake. They wouldn't import any sake. But very happily, I found out that many restaurants where we did the events, they were happy to buy the sake already. Mm. Straight away. So I was like, hey.
When was that, Pablo? When was that?
That was 2000. So we did the event, I think it was 2010. And yeah, 2010, 2011, I'm not really sure. And then I started straight away. At the beginning, very small quantities, few customers. It was almost like a hobby. But then every month was growing and people were getting interest. And also the thing I did is not going to Japanese restaurant, the obvious thing, because in Spain, probably Japanese restaurant, I mean, the real one, not the Chinese-run Japanese restaurant, they are quite expensive. So people go there for the food and they are willing to pay for the food, but they are not willing to pay for the drink. And as you know, in Spain, we have very cheap wines. So people maybe spend 10 euro in a nice white wine that goes really well with sushi. And they wouldn't bother to talk to me because when they saw the prices, they were like scared. Yeah. So I approach, I think I did a good move. I approached this three-star famous new Spanish gastronomy restaurants. And to be honest, at the beginning, they were like, no, we are not a Japanese restaurant. Why you come here? But I was saying, listen, you leave, give me just 5 minutes. I make you taste some real sake and then you let me know. So, okay, but, you know, I don't have much time. You know, we have to do many things. We are not going to put sake here on the list because, you know. But they would try sake and they would go, wow, what is this? This is not sake. This is first time I drink something like that. And they would eventually like, you know, we were looking for a drink for this complex dish that the chef is doing with vegetables and we didn't find any wine for it. And let's get sake for it and let's do it. So I was like, wow. And it didn't happen one time, two, three times. It was happening all the time when I visited this fancy restaurant that they were getting really surprised. They didn't have a clue what his sake was, but they really got into the flavors.
I think that's a really astute move because, I mean, as we all know, Spain, or what's happening in Spain at the moment in terms of culinary culture is really progressive, really innovative. These chefs are, you know, really pushing the boundaries of what is technique, what is traditional flavor, and they're looking outside the box of what is traditionally Spanish and very open-minded to things based on flavor and based on quality. And I think that that's a really astute move to approach those kinds of progressive restaurants, because that is the perfect sort of bed with which to grow a sake culture from, I think, in Spain.
Yeah, definitely. I think from El Bulli and Ferran Adrià and his team, they did an amazing, I mean, a revolution in Spain, because up to those days, Spain had a kind of complex. We had our traditional food, not very refined, but we were looking at the French with, well, these people, they are really cooking. We are not really well. And what El Bulli started to do, like leaving behind the complex and doing things in a new way without any fears, was now what we can call the revolution, the sons or the grandsons of Ferran Adrià in the sense of culinary matters. They are really doing cooking in a really relaxed, creative, and no complex way. And I think that's why we can introduce sake.
I had a remark and a question at the same time. To get more sake consumers, we need to get them to appreciate sake with what they have on the table. So being French, I'm looking at Spain from far, but you have a national dish, paella, which is not the same in Catalonia and in other parts of the country, I suppose. But actually, I think you can do great pairings between sake and paella. I mean, can you comment about pairing with your daily fare?
So when I was mentioning when we did this first really event with all the curas that we wanted to import in Spain, we did a tour of different cities in Spain, and of course everybody wanted to, we are in Spain, let's have paella. And after a morning tasting, we say, okay, we're gonna go this. I was in Barcelona. We're gonna go to this really nice paella place. Why don't we bring some bottles? And you know, but everybody, you know, it's funny. You, even the cura, curavito, and the curamoto people, they are like, you know, let's have wine now for a break, you know. But they say, okay, let's bring some sake, and it was absolutely nice, and it was pairing really amazingly. And they were like, yeah, this is rice, and we are drinking rice, and it makes sense. So then the people started to, okay, so can we make sake with this paella rice? And they're starting to...
How many bottles of sake did they drink at that stage?
Yeah, no. And you know, paella is a dish that... it's really famous, the seafood paella, as you know. But the real paella is only vegetables and probably rabbit and snails. That's the real one. And it's very, very, very thin. It's only one layer of rice in the whole pan. So you get like a huge pan, and maybe you are only two, like the side of like, I don't know, like 40 centimeters.
Like a pizza dish.
Like even bigger.
A huge pizza, right? Yeah, can still eat it between two.
Because it's really very thin.
So it's just all crunchy. It's all that great.
I bet it is, yeah.
So you told me that it was basically mountain food. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the... It was in Valencia, in the mountains of Valencia. So the pheasants that were working there, they got the rice. Then they got some rabbit and some... a vegetable there, and they were cooking in a big pan. So they didn't want to use dishes, so everybody was using a spoon.
Right.
So the traditional way to eat paella is just the big pan.
And then there were some snails marching by, and they
jumped in for fun.
Ended up.
Yes.
And then it, just because of the popularity and deliciousness of the dish, I believe then it kind of just slowly migrated down to the coastline where see it now.
That was tourism. When in the 50s, Spain became like a very strong country on tourism. Everybody was going to the coast and the Valencian coast and Mallorca, the Barcelona. So all that area. So the people were like, we are having this paella in the mountains. Why don't we do it here? And why don't we add the seafood? And that's the famous paella now. Yeah.
Absolutely. So can we just get an update on, you know, where is your company now? How many breweries do you represent and what's your main market in Spain?
Okay, so at the moment, and we are always increasing, but we go little by little because we have to be careful sometimes when we think about business and passion, because sometimes passion can ruin the business in the sense that when, every time I come here to Japan and I found out new sakes, I want to import them, but then it's something that I have to separate from business. But anyway, at the moment I have kind of, I think, around 18 breweries from different parts of Japan. I also do a little bit of, well, not soju in this case, but I do awamori. And I do some premium and very small brewers, well, brewers, yeah, from vinegar and soy sauce.
So fermentation, like things that are connected to sake and shochu world.
Yeah, but mainly I do sake.
And so can you give us an insight to, you know, I've actually, full disclosure, I've actually just been in Spain with Pablo recently. It was purely wine, though. I had a little bit of a sake holiday. But I'm curious what the reaction in the market from, you know, from the end consumer is about sake. What's some of the feedback that you're getting from the end consumer? And what are some of the issues that face a importer and a supplier such as yourself in Spain at the moment?
I would say that we are still, like many countries, fighting against the prejudice that sake gives. Like, this is a very strong alcohol drink and whatever. So we are fighting in that sense to make consumer find out that sake is a really nice drink. Many people, they are not very happy when I explain sake, but I want to compare it with wine. For several reasons, but I think in wine countries like us, we need to put it in the wine perspective. And I think it's something that is very, very close.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I'd like to hear everyone's thoughts on this and like talking about sake, explaining sake, perhaps in a wine context. I'm sure that there are pros and cons on either side. What are your thoughts on that, Sebastian?
Well, I think culturally, both are very, very close to start with. So people are relate to wine because of wine's culture. And so using the story of the wine culture and making comparisons or drawing parallels is quite useful in that regard.
I agree with that. And what are your thoughts on that, Chris?
I think you work with what the folks in the market, you know, wherever their foundation is, I think you play off of that. I think you got to riff off of it. But I've heard, especially with the sake wine comparison, I've heard a number of folks smack people down as soon as they
I've
try
very,
too hard.
I think it's a spectrum. I think there are people that are very, very much on, you know, let's speak in a way that people, in a way that it gives people an intuitive understanding of what sake is, you know, using the terminology, using some of the reference points which they already have from wine,
right,
and then building on that and extending on it and developing and extending their understanding of sake. And then I've heard the people that are complete opposite and are very, very, you know, orthodox in their opinions. I think that there's a happy medium anywhere. I mean,
it really
depends on how you approach it. And I've got, you know, hearing how Pablo talks about sake, I've got every confidence. The way that he's doing it is, you know, really not judging sake like a wine, but rather creating a framework for people to see sake and value sake as well, I think is quite important.
Yeah, and I think our future customers are wine drinkers, so we have to help them a little bit to understand sake. But sometimes, you know, some people ask for Riesling kind of sake, and there are some sake that they taste a little bit like Riesling. So I think it's completely different story, but it's a good way to get these people into sake. Then of course we have some issue, the labels, all these things that they don't get much information.
You mean not being able to read the labels
to read
or
the
labels. Back labels?
Yeah, the labels. So some people, we are forced, but not everybody is doing, to have a back label with all the information. But the information could be very, very simple. So I try to put a little bit more of information on the back label so people can understand a little bit more. But again, and that's a global issue, when people follow the classification of sake, they get a lot of confusion because
absolutely,
you know, like this is a daiginjo, but it doesn't taste floral, and you know, these kind of things. So I always try to say, you know, you try this sake and don't pour it in a frame. Just you enjoy it or you don't enjoy it, but
absolutely,
don't think too much about that. But of course, people need to have a base. They need to have a book to follow on sake, the rules. And I always say, like most of us know, that sake is not black or white. It has infinite grades. So I think that's the thing. And then on the import side, you know, sometimes we get a problem from the customs because they think this is... For instance, if a sake has some alcohol added, like non-jumai, then they say it's not sake, things like that. So I think there are some things that altogether we could make better.
Could you explain that a little bit for some of our listeners who aren't so familiar with importing sake? You are having some problems with extra tax duties or being given penalties because sake is a very broad spectrum. There is junmai sake, then there's alcohol added styles, and it's the alcohol added styles which are creating problems with the customs officials. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, I think that the main issue is like sake has a code for imports. I guess it's the same code for all the countries, but that code doesn't specify that it's only sake. It could be any fermented drink. So that's what causes a little bit of problem and confusion, because some people, especially this particular custom guy in Valencia, is really concerned about the sakes that are non-jumai. So he thinks that those cannot be classified as sake because the alcohol that those drinks have are from an addition of alcohol, but in fact it's very small. I would like to know what's the percentage, but I'm sure it's really, really small.
I think definitely in the terms of your ginjo-shu grades, for example, honjozo, ginjo, daiginjo, it's a marginal, it's a very, very small percentage, so much so that I believe that it doesn't really significantly increase the overall alcohol percentage.
Especially because sake is diluted afterwards anyway.
Right. Yeah. So I think this, we're hearing from the Spanish market that obviously not only at an end consumer level, but also at a more official level, a lot of sake education is needed to help people to properly understand and appreciate, and also to tax sake.
Yeah.
So I think that is also a really global problem, because I think even in Japan, when we're doing seminars, actually anywhere in the world where we're doing seminars and we're explaining the difference between a junmai and a non-junmai style, everyone just goes, eh? So I think that, yeah, this is something that the community needs to work together and find a solution for, because it's not just the Spanish market, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Pablo, you mentioned awamori earlier, and I'm really interested in how that's working in the Spanish market. What ways are you presenting awamori, and how many brands of awamori do you have in your portfolio?
Okay, awamori was a bit of a dream and a memory of my trip to Okinawa. And when I was living in Japan, I wasn't much into soju, but I kind of liked the awamori culture and awamori. So I decided to import this only brand to Spain. It was a nightmare because here for sake is not a problem, but for spirits, European laws didn't allow to bring 1.8, the Ishobin was not allowed it. And the 720 also was not allowed. So we had to ask the brewery to put a sticker with 1750 on the label, even though it was a little bit more. And then finally we got it.
Should you be telling us this?
I know. But now it's okay. Now finally they realized that that was something that is stupid. But anyway, we started to import this awamori. And we are a little bit stuck because the whiskey boom came. And everybody is like, from Japan, the only liqueur that exists is whiskey. And then... yeah, but this is not soju, and this is another thing. I say, yeah, but this probably is the oldest alcoholic drink. I mean, the spirit, yeah, in Japan, and yeah, and I was thinking that I would like take off at some point because a very famous restaurant started to use our awamori for instead of pisco sour. He was doing an awamori sour. It was really nice. But then he closed down the restaurant. and I was starting to get a little bit of traffic on the awamori. But then it's like, it takes time. And also, I think awamori in Spain is like whatever. I mean, there's nothing on awamori and it's very hard to introduce. So I'm like, okay, I have it. I'm trying to use it sometime for events, but people don't really, they are still into the sake now from me, so the awamori is an extra thing that it didn't take off yet, but probably soon it will again, I guess.
I have a question because I'm seeing Spain as a country of many different cultures and regional cultures, and how do you see your market? Do you see differences between the various Spanish regions?
You know, now if some Spanish people will hear me, they might be like, wow.
Oh, be careful. God.
No, but yeah, I agree with you. I think Spain is a country of different countries, but somehow in food, gastronomic, drinks-wise, football, everybody is kind of the same in the way that they really enjoy doing the same things. Barcelona, San Sebastian, Madrid, they like to go out. They're each place they have their own tapas style culture, their own drinks, their own wines. So I think in a global way, I think it's about the same. But of course, if I'm based in Madrid, I'm not from Madrid, but I'm based in Madrid. Maybe if I was based in Barcelona, I would sell more in Barcelona. I don't know. So it's not of a problem of the things that I carry or whatever. It's more a problem of, yeah, you have to be there. Maybe the people appreciate you more because you are from that region or something. But in terms of enjoyment I cannot say, sake is very famous in Madrid and in Barcelona it's not popular. It doesn't work like that. I mean, it's every place is somehow very close I cannot find a place in Spain that they don't like sake.
If anyone follows Pablo on social media, you'll be aware of the incredible events that you do related to sake, collaborations with some of the world's best, in fact, world's best 50. I think you probably got most of those people on your instant dial on your phone. Pablo is creating these incredible events, which are not only sake experiences, but culinary experiences, wine experiences, really bringing sake into a culinary family of sorts. And I'd just like to, if you could share some events that you've been doing, some events that might be of interest to our listeners and maybe events that they could participate in the future.
Yeah, of course. So we like to put sake on the market in Spain, for instance, not related to Japanese restaurant, as I said. So last year, World Best 50 was held in Bilbao. So there is a very nice restaurant there that we work with called Mina. We organized a dinner and all the drinks that we were serving were sake. And many people, not only foreigners that they came there for the event, but locals, they really enjoyed that event because they felt like, okay, we are here in Bilbao, is the capital world of culinary event tonight, and we are having this cooking from this chef, from Alvaro. He's really talented, doing modern Basque cooking, but all the pairing was with sake, and they were really surprised. I was also being a bit naughty in the sense that I was serving some nama sake that was aged in our... We have a facility where we keep our sake at very low temperature.
What temperature are you storing at?
So we have between -5 and 0. So we were keeping this nama sake for 3 years, and everybody was like, oh, confusing. Oh, it's nama, but it's old, but wow, but it tastes good.
So nama sake is unpasteurized sake for some of our new listeners.
Yeah, so I think that's... creates a little bit of a buzz, like, oh, we are in Spain and we can have this nama sake, and then on top of that is age. Or we did with another brewery that he didn't know, and I thought he would be very, very upset, but we couldn't sell his, we left like 2 cases of his sake because they were like 2 years old. And then we send it to a winery, a really famous winery, and we let them there age a little bit more. Doesn't make any sense in the way that it's not in a barrel or whatever, but just...
So this was at ambient temperature?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we kept them like 6 years. And then he came to Madrid and we did an event. And then I said, oh my God, we are doing only his sakes tonight, but I want to see his face about this project. So we put a sticker on his sake with the winery, and we say, you know, we've been aging this sake here for 6 years. If you don't like it, please let me know. I you taste it, but if you like it, I would like to share with all the people here. And he went like, wow, that's amazing. It tastes really nice. I'm really glad you did that. And I was like, wow. Then it's a collaboration without telling.
Guerrilla collaboration. I like it.
Tell me, going back to your events, was the menu special for the day, or was it the regular menu and you just work on the pairings?
Yeah, it was. The base was his regular menu. And then he had a few dishes that he wanted to create for the event. But it was like really spontaneous. Like I think I went the day before, and I knew a little bit. I wanted to introduce this kind of sakes. Sake, you all know, it's not complicated in the sense that we always kind of find a dish for it. But we had a lunch together. We were trying and different sakes together, and it went very yeah. That's it. And I think people were really, really happy.
So who was mainly involved in putting the food and the sake pairing together? Was that something that you worked with the sommelier on, or was that just totally driven by you?
Yeah, I was me that I selected the sake for the dishes. And yeah, the sommelier was, you know, sommeliers, if they are, they don't have any education on sake, they are really scared to touch sake. But when they taste it, and you guide them a little bit, then they are completely happy. And
because it's all about your palate. It doesn't matter really whether you're drinking apple juice, wine, or, I don't know, milk. I mean, your palate is your palate. You know what you like. You know what you don't like. You know what has got a lot of acidity. You know what's got a lot of residual sugar. You know, so I think it's great for these kinds of very high-end sommeliers who are really the gateway for sake. I mean, you're providing the access, but they are creating the end consumer experience. Getting these sommeliers on board, I think, must be a really important part of the journey in building Spain. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm just the messenger in the sense that I bring something from Japan that maybe was not available in Spain. But the hard work is the sommeliers. I mean, the sommeliers are the showroom for us in the sense that they kind of force regular customer to drink sake. If they were asked, we have this wine, this wine, this wine, this sake, this wine, most of the times they would choose wine. But in a way, they are like, okay, with this dish, it comes with this sake. Do you have any problem? Most of the time they say, I don't like sake, but I will try. And that's the thing that I go like, yeah, I'm sure they're going to love it. And they taste it and they drink sake and they are like, wow, this is sake?
It's amazing. It's, you know, so many people have, and this is so totally natural. I think I also had the same thinking when I first came to Japan before I had my epiphany, was that if you have an image of what sake is, or perhaps unfortunately like you did, you had maybe one bad experience that kind of made you a bit gun-shy of sake, you put this wall up and you're just like, no, I don't like it, before you even taste it. And, you know, the sommeliers, you're right, they are influencers.
Yeah.
And getting them to serve sake with confidence and surety is such an important part of creating amazing end consumer experiences.
That's for sure. And also another thing that I'm kind of enjoying a lot is like using like key ingredients or key food products from Spain with sake. For instance, Iberico ham. Everybody knows now Iberico ham, but probably one of the best pairing for Iberico ham would be sake. You know, many people think red wine. Red wine doesn't work with Iberico ham. Sherry could be a good one, and also from Spain, or champagne. But sake, it's amazing. And everybody's like, no, come on, that's too much, Pablo. You are doing something crazy. This is something that you're doing only for making noise. But then when they taste it, I mean, really nice Jumai, Yamaha with a really good, well, now my mouth is watering. But it's like, are at the same level, and people really get,
well,
wow.
It makes sense. If you think of sherry, you've got those wonderful nutty notes and a slightly oxidized nose, which works well with the smokiness and the richness of Iberico ham. I'm thinking of a slightly aged Junmai, or maybe even a slightly oxidized Nama could be really compelling.
Yeah, and the best of it is that you don't need to talk. I mean, you don't need to explain sake. It speaks by itself with the ham. It's like, wow, yeah, it's really nice. I like sake now.
Well, actually, I mean, we've heard that story from a lot of people. I myself, and I think Sebastian will be much more authoritative on this topic than me, but anything fermented is a natural vehicle for pairing with sake, pretty much. I mean, for example, Sebastian, cheese and sake is one of your specialties.
Specialty, I don't know, but...
Or have I just made that your specialty?
But yeah, I've done a few things around cheese and sake recently, and I'm trying to spend more and more time researching the area, because I think it's a great pairing needs more exploration, but will impose itself, I think.
And I think something like ham and cheese is so approachable, they're so accessible, you know, to a consumer. It's something which is just simply delicious. Just to follow up, I believe that there was a sake and shochu judging competition in Spain recently. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. That was in April. It was the first sake and shochu competition inside a wine and spirit competition that has been taking place for the last 10 years in Spain. And they asked me to coordinate a little bit, like help them to get some breweries to send the samples and all that. And then I selected a little bit the judges. So I wanted to have a very, basically a lot of Spanish famous sommeliers. And then we got some people from Japan, from the US, and it was the first time. And yeah, I think it was a surprise, because having in the same room, of course, there were only two tables judging all the sakes and the shochu, but having a full room with different sommeliers or wine people there, it was really interesting. And at the end, we had around 280 sakes and not so many shochu, around 20 shochus. But yeah, the quality was really good, and the sakes we had were also really good. Yeah.
So do the winners of that event get one of those little seals or stickers that you put on the bottle to show that they've won? And is that having an effect on the retail market?
Well, I think, for instance, in Spain, it could have, because everybody in Spain is happy that we did this kind of competition. And also it's making a little bit of noise on sake. In my particular view, it's really good for retail because, you know, people always try to like when they see a sticker with a gold medal or something, they rather choose that particular sake than other. So I think in that sense it's good. And as we were talking before about the restaurants, and we didn't talk about retail. In Spain, it's not very common to see a sake unless it's a really cheap and sometimes non-Japanese sake on the shelf. But now it's starting to take place, and there is this big chain of high-end kind of stores called El Corte Inglés that is having sake there. And now we are talking to them to see if the winner of that competition can be on the shelf for their gourmet experience, which is the top shop they have for only gourmet products. So in that sense, it helps.
Any internet sales taking place in Spain about sake?
Yeah, there are... most of the main wine distributors, they have an online selling channel through, let's say, Amazon. They have a shop there, and it's actually possible to get sake. I was really surprised because a friend of mine said, "Oh, I just ordered a sake this morning and I got it this afternoon." I was like, "Really?" And yeah, I bought it in Amazon. I was like, "My sake? You bought it in Amazon?" Yeah, through this. And they have this like a speedy service. I was like, wow, that's amazing. So yes, it's possible to sell. We set up an online market in our website, and to be honest, it's not very very important. But sometimes we get a nice surprise. Somebody's spending a lot of money in sake, so it's like, wow, yeah, it works. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. So Pablo, you've obviously got a lot of exciting plans coming up. Could you let us know what's on the calendar for you this year?
Yeah, so in September, that's something not related to Spain in a way. It's more sake and the real guys. We are bringing to Madrid and Barcelona Kimura-san and Nitome-san.
Is tempura and sushi.
And sushi. And of course, we're going to use sake, but also I'm going to put some maybe sherry or whatever on the menu. But I think it's a good opportunity for many Spanish people that they cannot come here, unfortunately, to taste their aged sushi and Nitome-san tempura. So we are really looking for it.
And those are obviously two very, very special restaurants. For those of you who aren't big followers of Japanese cuisine or the restaurants in Japan, Sushi Kimura is a 2-star Michelin sushi restaurant that specializes in maturing the fish that's used for the netta or the top component on the rice, which is something he is extremely talented in and creates incredible flavor profiles and textures with his technique. And the tempura restaurant, could you give us a bit more information about that?
Yeah, that's a Nagoya tempura restaurant that didn't want to get into Tabelog, but when he allowed...
Tabelog is like a Japan's, I suppose, Yelp, but 100 times better.
Yeah, and I don't know if now Nagoya, they got the Michelin star. I don't know if he got any, but probably yes. And it's an amazing experience. It's one of the top tempuras here in Japan. And actually, it's an event that a common friend, Aiste from Luxit, did in London and in probably this year in Paris. So they wanted to go to Spain because these guys are really funny. They want to work a little bit, of course, and I'm very hard. But also they want to spend some time going to restaurants there. So it's like when Rebecca, you came to Spain. I think people really need to, for instance, sake people going to wine country places to learn about the producers and exchange some ideas. I think it's very important for everyone. So I think for the chefs as well.
Absolutely. I definitely think with Kimura-san, who with his aging technique and the tempura chef. I mean, tempura came from the Iberico Peninsula. So, you know, there's a nice connection to Japan there.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. You know, that's I was talking about that yesterday, and then I thank you for reminding me because it's true.
Yeah,
and
it's kind of a homecoming in a way, isn't it?
Since you're bringing Japanese chefs into Spain, maybe you try to pair it with Spanish sake. So can you tell us a bit about what's happening there?
Now there are two Spanish breweries. Both are in Catalonia. One is
Catalonia is north of Portugal, is that?
No. Catalonia is the Barcelona area.
Oh, that's right. The region. Sorry, there. My geography is terrible.
And one is called Kensho Sake, and the other one is Seda Liquida, using, for instance, the Kensho Sake is using the rice and the water from Delta del Ebro in Catalonia. And Seda Liquida is using the water, and now he cultivated some Japanese rice in the Pyrenees. Okay, and I mean it's really really nice to have two curas in Spain because they are helping, of course, to promote the culture. And I think now, and I want to relate it to another thing that we are doing with some friends in Europe. We are trying to build the European Sake Association because now we are fearing that there would be a boom of sake producers, but somebody somehow has to control that is properly sake, because we are hearing that some people is taking the advantage of the buzz that now sake is making and putting this is sake, and maybe they use rice, but then they add alcohol and flavors. And I think somehow there must be a regulation or something. So we are trying to build this association in Europe to control somehow this, and also to give a lot of information for people who is willing to start making sake to get all the. So now we are trying to build this with the help of, we hope, from Japanese authorities, for the information, for how to grow the rice, so things like that. And of course, don't confuse people and stay.
Yeah, that's really admirable and also a hugely challenging project. Good luck with that. And please keep us updated on because I mean I think that's something that is definitely a topic of debate around you know the tables in Japan, between brewers, between consumers, restaurant owners, about this overseas sake boom. And I think, by and large, it's incredibly positive. I think everyone wants sake to extend around the world. I do think that the negative, the cause of concern is, but it's so unregulated. You know, I think everyone wants the best for these brewers. They want these brewers to be successful. They're thankful that they are expanding sake culture within their country, but just it's a little bit cowboy, I think, out there at the moment, and that could actually end up being damaging to brand sake if it's unregulated.
Yeah. So I think it should be something to regulate and put everybody, all the industry together. I know it's hard, but it would be very nice to have everybody like got together and support sake in different issues. So
I'd like to, we're talking about issues related to sake. I'd like to just go back to, we were talking about some challenges that you have in expanding the Spanish market. I mean, obviously you're doing an amazing job, but I'm really curious as to what the major hurdle for you is. You mentioned that sake is very expensive. So can you tell me why it's so expensive when it hits the Spanish market? Because I believe that there's a new EU free trade agreement starting, but you say that the sake is still very expensive.
Yeah, mainly it's transportation cost. We are trying to bring sake in the best possible condition. So that means airplane refrigerated or by reefer container. Then keep sake in a warehouse at controlled temperature also is very, very important for us. And it makes the cost of sake very, very hard. And also delivery in Spain, it's the prices are quite expensive. For instance, I think if we bring a container from Japan, almost half of the price of this transportation would be from the port to Madrid, for instance. So it's crazy. So that's something that is eventually, of course, if the volume increases, then we can reduce the cost. But then we get the second issue, that is the bottling date and the time that is in the shelf of the shops or the restaurants. So that's also another...
Do you mean people are holding onto the bottles for too long? Is that correct?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And also it's a kind of tricky situation because, of course, the producer, when they come to Spain or maybe London or wherever, where they go, they tend to see or search their sakes and the bottling date. And they are like, wow, this is already 2 years. You cannot have it in the market. But I think it's really hard. And I think between the producer, the importers, we have to try to find a way out. And probably the best way, but still it's expensive, would be to ship small quantities in short time. That means maybe LCL. So it's...
Let me just tease that for some of our listeners. What basically is happening is for importers to have a refrigerated container and to determine the temperature of it, they need to buy or rent the entire container. That's called FCL or a full container load. That means that they've got full control over the temperature of that container and the sake inside is assured of quality. However, if you're only buying a couple of cases of sake, you can't really get the whole container. You can't get a whole 40-foot. So you will do a mixed container, and that container might be shared with a whole of other people who may have different storage temperature needed for their products inside. So you can't really determine what the price of that container is. So people who are really, you know, concerned about the quality of their sake would be getting a full container load, but that pricing is then going to be divided amongst every single bottle, which will make it incredibly expensive.
How many bottles in an FCL?
The full container is 11,000 or something like that. Yeah. So basically, I don't import like a full container. I try to do half or whatever. The cost, it would be much more cheaper than air shipment. I can have my own container with the temperature I want, so I put it very cold. But I get a lot of stock, and that's another problem. So the ideal situation, and it's something that is not happening in Spain, is share a container with the different importers. But everybody's doing their own thing, and we don't have a share container with controlled temperature. This doesn't exist. So that's a problem. Then the other thing would be to have regular shipments by air. But to give you an idea, probably every bottle costs between 7 to 10 euros extra for the air shipment. Yeah. So.
And also, I mean, on a quality standpoint, air shipment is not very gentle on sake. The vibration, the sharp temperature differences can create a lot of internal structural shifting in the sake. So it's generally regarded that that shipping is the best, but it takes a long time and you've got to have large volumes. So this is really a challenge, and I hope this is something which is not just Spain. This is definitely global. I mean, I'm sure that it's the same in France. No?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we had a conversation when we were in Spain actually about another amazing idea that you had, which was about a sake hub, distribution hub.
Yeah. That I know it would be very, very hard, but if somehow we get like a hub in Europe of like a warehouse where they can keep unboned at a very low temperature the sakes and get regular shipments from Japan, and then we can pick it up there and ship to all the countries, that would make a lot of sense. And we can have like a fresh rotation and like really decrease the price of the product. I think that would be fantastic. But I think it's not easy, but at some point it should be like the answer for it. And also in an environmental friendly way, I think it would be much nicer if all of the importers, we try to contaminate the less using like a full container and share this thing instead of, oh, now I'm in a hurry, okay, let's ship it by air. Or now I do like my own container, but it's half. So yeah, it's challenging, but it would make really sense.
Well, it sounds as though this idea that you have of creating a European Sake Association and the hub are actually probably very compatible ideas. Having that forum is you're also creating a potential community of people that could be involved in the hub and also monitor it as well as take responsibility for how it's controlled and managed. Well, it sounds like you've got a lot of exciting projects and a lot of very big and challenging projects, and we are just so thankful for everything that you are doing in both Japan and around the world. So how can our viewers who are listening to us today get in touch with you about sake or be involved in one of your events?
Okay, so probably I have an Instagram account, Salvioni / Alomar, and then we post all the things we are doing and everybody can follow, and I would be very glad to hear from you, and really thanks everyone here for having me here, and I hope to come back and maybe with some ideas or maybe some things we have been talking here taking place.
Well, please bring some chefs over. Definitely love to attend that event. Well, everyone, I hope that you will follow Pablo on his social media, and also he's got an event coming up in September. I believe that's open to the public. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So follow him on social media for updates on that incredible event. I might start looking into some airfares myself. Sounds very tempting. Well, Pablo, thank you so much for your time. It's really been fascinating hearing more about your market and what's going on in Spain. And thank you, everyone, for your insightful comments.
Thank you very much, Pablo. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you very much.
Well, everyone, that is a wrap for us here at Sake on Air. You can't see us, but we're all holding, as you know, a glass of sake. So here's a big kampai to all of our listeners. Thank you so much. And we look forward to talking to you again at the next edition of Sake on Air. Kampai!
Salud!
Salud!
Bye-bye.
Kampai. Salud.